I want to begin by showing you a map of Alaska. Go ahead, guys, show that picture there. All right. Barrow, Alaska is the northernmost town in the state of Alaska. And from November, late November, all the way through March, the sun actually goes below the horizon. So for those months that the residents there, those 4,000 residents, live in Barrow, Alaska, the sun is unseen. It's like midnight. It's dark. There's not even a glow. And yet, while the sun is unseen, the people of Barrow, Alaska, are still confident and believe that the sun is there. And Esther teaches us a similar truth, that while God oftentimes is unseen, he is not absent. So we've titled our series this beginning today, Esther, God's Silent Sovereignty. And I want us to begin in the book of Deuteronomy. You don't have to turn there. I just want to show you these words. These are Moses' final words to the people of Israel before he leaves them. And he says to them in Deuteronomy 28, if you are not careful to do all the words of this law that are written in the book, the Lord will, what do you see next? Scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other. Your Old Testament book is a record book of the nation of Israel being scattered and being reclaimed. In fact, Esther is a partial record of God's people being scattered. Now, you are in your table of contents, and I need to get there as well. I want you to look at this. First of all, if you're new to the Bible, this is actually very helpful. Your Old Testament is not written chronologically. So if you read in your Old Testament and all of a sudden you're going from Deuteronomy and then you're going into Joshua, Judges, Ruth, not all those books are chronological. But I want to show you four books in your Old Testament. Do you see where it says 2 Chronicles? You see that? 2 Chronicles. A lot of times we'll say 2 Chronicles. Here's what you have, all right? I'm going to talk about 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, real briefly. In 2 Chronicles chapter 36, the final 5 verses are a history of God scattering his people. God raised up this empire known as the Babylonian Empire. And in the year 605 BC, the Babylonian Empire went into Jerusalem. And when they went into Jerusalem, what did they do? They ransacked the temple. They exiled the people. That is, they shipped the people out of Israel across the nation. In that exile, you could include Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Esther's parents, no doubt, her uncle Mordecai. She may have been just a small girl. Actually, maybe she wouldn't have even been born at the time. Jerusalem and the temple are the center of Israel's worship. Now there are no temples. There's no temple. There's no priests. There's no sacrifices. That's at the very end of 2 Chronicles 36, those final 5 to 8 verses. What are the next books that you see after 2 Chronicles? You see Ezra and Nehemiah. These are not chronological because Ezra and Nehemiah skip forward 130 years. They skip forward 130 years. Hang on, guys. Just don't show any more on that quite yet. 130 years, Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ezra and Nehemiah teach this. Ezra and Nehemiah are God's prophets. They speak to the people of Israel, but they speak specifically to the people of Israel who are where? Back in Jerusalem. So Ezra and Nehemiah teach us this. This is how God deals with his people who go back to Jerusalem. They still hear his voice, right? God's covenant people who are obedient to go back and rebuild the wall, to rebuild the temple. This is how God deals with his covenant people who are faithful to him, Ezra and Nehemiah. But Esther shows us something different. How does God deal with his covenant people who are not faithful to him? How does God deal with his covenant people who are still living in Susa, which is Iran? Only 50,000 Jews went back to Jerusalem. Let me show you this 130-year timeline of Israel's history. In 605, this is the Jewish captivity. This is when Daniel would have been taken, and Esther's parents, no doubt, or her uncle. This year, in 539, Daniel prophesies in Daniel chapter 6, I believe, and he tells his Babylonian king, right? Daniel is now third in charge, and he tells the king who has this vision. What does he say to him? Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, while you are having your party, another empire is going to come crashing in, and it's the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. And so, sure enough, 536 rolls around. The Medes and Persians take over, and 50,000 Jews head back to Jerusalem. In 486, now the Persians are in charge. Babylon is long gone. The Persians are in charge, and Ahasuerus is now king. Esther eventually will become his queen. And then you can see 12 years later, you've got the rescue of the Jewish people. And so here's, while you're turning to the book of Esther, here is what Esther is teaching. You know what, I forgot two little bullet points down here. Go ahead, show us these next. I think there's something down here. Yeah, one more? There he is, good. Ezra and Nehemiah, they're 130 years down the road. So Haggai and Zechariah, those are prophets who are actually living during the time of Esther, and they would have been with these 50,000 people who are going to Jerusalem. So here's the point of your Old Testament, or part of the point is, Haggai and Zechariah are God's testimony of how he cares for his covenant people who are obedient to him and go back to Jerusalem. Ezra and Nehemiah is a testimony to how God is faithful to his covenant people back in Jerusalem. But that's only 50,000 folks. What about the millions who are spread all across the empire? What does God do with unfaithful covenant people? How does he respond to them? That's the story of Esther. Because to those who remain scattered throughout the Persian Empire, God is silent. There's no prophet to speak to them. God is so silent that God's name isn't even found in the book of Esther. You read the 10 chapters, you won't find God's name. He's that silent, and that is intentional to communicate to the readers, we who are reading, that God is silent, not just in the book of Esther, but that he's also silent to the people who are living in Persia. So here's the big idea this morning, that when it appears that God is absent or silent, we learn that God is active and sovereign. When it appears that God is absent or silent, what we learn is that God is actually active and sovereign. And so our message this morning is titled, When God is Silent. Friends, he is still active. And I want to give you three observations from Esther 1 that demonstrate that God is active. Here's the first one. That God thwarts the plans and schemes of power, of the powerful, to establish his kingdom. That in Esther 1, God thwarts the plans and schemes of the powerful to establish his kingdom. When Susan read for us Esther 1, the opening description of Ahasuerus' kingdom is intended to shock you. It's intended to overwhelm. It's even intended, I would put it this way, to repulse the reader of Ahasuerus' extravagant display of wealth. This is just opulent. This is way too much. Look at it in verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. And while he showed them the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, how many? 180. And when these days were completed, he wasn't done. The king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, great and small, a feast for them lasting for 7 days. In the court of the garden, the king's palace, there was white cotton curtains, violet hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen, purple and silver rods, marble pillars, and couches of gold and silver. Mosaic pavements of porphyry and marble, mother of pearl and precious stone, drinks were given. And the order was this: there is no compulsion, meaning drink up, man. Have as much as you want. This is intended to overwhelm the reader of Ahasuerus' wealth. So think of it this way. Think of military parade on steroids. Think of Kim Jong-un or whoever's in charge right now and the various military parades, but don't think of it for like an hour or a day or 3 days. Think of it going on for 180 days. You and I, when we show something of value, we carefully pull it out of its hiding place and we show it to our guests, right? Ahasuerus was like, break open the closet, man, for 180 days. Let's just let it all pass through and everybody to be impressed. Because of the vastness of his kingdom, Ahasuerus, this was kind of like, this was a modern day United Nations there in Susa, in his summer palace. His kingdom ran from India to Ethiopia. This is a king who displays his palatial, luxurious wealth for 180 days. Hosting a party for influential guests from the vast empire, the entire city. This unlimited drinking supply. Did you notice when Susan read it, it talked about handcrafted goblets and not one of them was the same. This is a man who had enough goblets that were handcrafted. Handcrafted that were so exquisite that he had one for each person, is the idea. This unparalleled beauty with couches of gold and silver on a floor of massive cut stones. They've done excavations in Susa, which is a city that is still in existence in Iran, that reveal the descriptions of Ahasuerus where he self-identifies this way. Listen to these descriptions of himself. King of kings. King of nations. Now I can think, when we're reading Esther chapter 1, I can think of two temples that are described with such beauty. Can you? I can think of the original temple itself, right, that Solomon will build, is described with such intricate detail that it too rivaled Ahasuerus' palace. I can think of another location that is described with such exquisite beauty that it too, not rivals, but actually will surpass Ahasuerus' palace. Where is that? Heaven in the Revelation 21. And so if you're living in this context of Susa, you may be thinking to yourself, if you're a Jewish person, will the real king please stand up? Right? Is the king of heaven reigning? Or is the despot Ahasuerus reigning? Friends, Ahasuerus takes up just a few paragraphs in the history books of the world. We know that his empire will vanish, others will arise. The Roman Empire will soon come after this, actually the Greek Empire and then the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, they will attempt to destroy the infant Christian church. I can think of other empires. The Roman Empire will pass away, but the church will go on. Hitler and his goal of world domination, exterminating the Jews, with all the havoc that he wreaked, he and his Third Reich are gone. In the 1950s, communist Russia's attempt to quiet believers by imprisoning their pastors and their leaders. If you're a consumer of news, you may have seen even over this past week and weeks prior to that, I read that the Chinese government is closing Christian churches left and right. And I would even, in some small ways, place our own country as she attempts to censor the message of the gospel, attempting to confine it to buildings. But friends, what we learn of Ahasuerus is this, that history is a record of one nation after another, one empire after another, attempting to make themselves a fixed and forever empire. But friend, scriptures teach us that the only kingdom that is unstoppable is Christ's kingdom. Right? Maturing, brothers and sisters, maturing believers understand that our identity is not first and foremost national or political. Friends, vote and participate, but brothers and sisters, does your world become unraveled by whomever is in office? I say this for this reason. Who is in charge in Esther chapter 1? Ahasuerus or the King of Heaven? And we bring these applications into our own day, and we can wring our hands and lose sleep at night. Now, as a Christian pastor, I am all for religious liberty. But regardless of how a Supreme Court rules, whether there is a progressive or a conservative majority in power does not change what a Christian pastor believes and teaches, and neither should it change you. Our agenda is not set by DC. Our agenda is determined by the King of Heaven. And God's people labor for an eternal kingdom, not made with hands, not made with hands. For our King, our hope, He sits, He rules, and He reigns in the heavens. And His kingdom outlasts and overcomes all kingdoms. This is part of what you're supposed to be getting as you read Ahasuerus. And if you're picturing yourself as a Jewish person in this Persian Empire, you're wondering to yourself, will the real king please stand up? For God thwarts the plans and schemes of the powerful because He will establish His kingdom. And while His kingdom, brothers and sisters, is not visible, it cannot be seen, it will still march on, and you and I are a part of it. I want to show you number two, that God uses the whims and impulses of people to prepare His plans. God uses the whims and impulses of people to prepare His plans. In verses 10 through 12, what you have is this. Vashti, Queen Vashti, is commanded to enter so that the king's drunken frat party friends can be entertained. Now, even for Persian standards, this is unheard of. And little did Ahasuerus know that God would use his drunkenness to accomplish God's plans. Little did Queen Vashti know that in her rightfully indignant response, that God was moving the chess pieces to save his covenant people, even those who were unfaithful to him. Friends, little did Esther know that when her daddy and mama died, and she was brought under the care of Uncle Mordecai, that one day she would be queen. Esther is teaching us that God uses the whims and impulses of people, even sinful, wicked people, to further and accomplish His plan. Friend, God is weaving in your life a beautiful tapestry of His design. And His plan in your life, friends, whether it be your hair color, your language, your accent, your background, your strengths, your weaknesses, and may I even add this, even your mistakes, or can I say this, even your sin that you feel has forever changed your life, that God, in only the way a sovereign God can, is using all things to bring about his eternal glory through your life. God uses the whims and impulses of people. We put it this way, he is the only one who can use sin in a sinless way. Friend, you are not here this morning. You are not sitting in those incredibly uncomfortable chairs, right? I've sat in them before. You are not sitting in that chair by random chance. Divine providence has brought you here on this morning. And he brought you here for this reason. That either you need the teaching for the very first time, or you need the reassurance from Scripture that while God may appear silent, he is at work in your life. What you perceive to be the silence of God is God actually arranging his sovereign plan. Your marriage trouble, your financial pressures, your children, your grandchildren, your singleness, your joblessness, your classmates. It is part of God's sovereign plan that he is weaving together a beautiful tapestry. That God uses, folks, Esther is teaching us this, that God uses the whims and impulses of even sinful people to accomplish his plans. Esther 1 is teaching us at a high level. Later on, as we get into Esther, it'll teach us at a microscopic level, at an individual level, but Esther 1 is teaching that God moves at a macro level, at a high level. At a 30,000-foot level, moving the kings and prime ministers and powers into position that he does for him to accomplish his plans. And lastly, the final third of the final really half of the chapter, we see this, that God reveals the wisdom and counsel of the world to contrast his wisdom. God reveals the wisdom and counsel of the world to contrast his wisdom. The final half of Esther 1 is an introduction to divine comedy. What does a sense of humor look like in the Bible? Right? Ahasuerus calls his counselors to ask them what should be done. It really is amusing. Look at verse 16, right? In verse 16, we read this. Ahasuerus has asked the question, what are we supposed to do? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, well, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but she's actually done wrong against all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. The queen's behavior will be made known to all women. This is what he's concerned about. The queen's behavior is going to be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say to the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. Listen to this wisdom, right? If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, right? Like, she didn't want to in the first place, right, Memucan? And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husband, high and low alike. The advice pleased the king, and so what did they do? They sent what Vashti did throughout all 127 provinces. right? Kind of countering what Memucan was so very concerned about. Right? Not the wisest of counselors. Banish her from your presence, which is what she wanted, at least initially. And we don't want the women of the empire knowing this. And so they send out this decree explaining the significance of the decree. The point is this, this authoritarian king who will even say, no, you drink more, right? He can't even control, so to speak, his own queen. And here's what Psalm chapter 2 teaches us, that the true king sits in the heavens and laughs at the so-called wisdom of the world. Esther 1 is a case that God reveals the wisdom and counsel of the world and contrasts it to his wisdom. Now I want to conclude with two primary applications for you. Esther reminds us this. Here's the first one. Esther reminds us that God is omnipotently present even when God is most conspicuously absent. Christian, we should be reminded that God is omnipotently, all-powerfully present, even when God is most conspicuously absent. Friends, when God is silent, he is still at work in your life. Beloved, we tend to judge God's presence, right, by looking around. But the scriptures teach us to judge his presence not by looking around, but by looking up to him. That is, we tend to judge God how? We tend to judge God by a stopwatch. God, I prayed this way. Come on, let's go. Here we go. Right? But the longer we walk with God, we can only judge God's faithfulness with a calendar. And not by the weeks or the months, but by the years. Esther reminds us that while God is at times is conspicuously absent, he is still omnipotently present. And secondly, Esther reminds us this, that unlike Ahasuerus, that God rules his kingdom for the good of his covenant people. For friends, you see, there is another king who will have a lavish banquet one day. And he will do so with jaw-dropping, beautiful surroundings. There will be streets of gold. There will be gates of gems. And everyone in this kingdom, from the greatest to the least, will partake in this supper. But it will not last for 180 days. It will last for eternity. And folks, to get into this kingdom, you don't declare your allegiance to Ahasuerus. You declare your allegiance to the one true king whose kingdom never comes to an end, King Jesus. And I say this to you, this king will call you into his presence, not to banish you forever, not to humiliate you, for others to leer or jeer at you, but he will call you into his presence to clothe you with his very own robes of righteousness. Is God at work when it appears that God is silent or even hidden? Friends, the most obvious answer is yes, with the prime example being this. When the Father hid his face from his Son, Christ, that even when Jesus cried out from the cross, the Father was silent, yet God's silence demonstrates that he is omnipotently active in rescuing a people for himself, in that he gave his only Son, that whosoever will believe on him will never die, but have everlasting life. Brian Gregory is a Presbyterian pastor who has a commentary on the book of Esther. he gives this illustration in his book. He talks about one of Rembrandt's famous paintings, kind of dark in here, or kind of light, too light to see that dark painting. It's called The Night Watch. This painting is 13 feet wide and 16 feet high there in Amsterdam. I want you to imagine walking into a room and standing behind two artists. These two artists, there's a teacher and a student. And after admiring the painting for a while, the teacher asks the student to find Rembrandt in the painting. And the reason why he did that is because Rembrandt was known for actually painting himself into the various paintings that he produced. And so naturally, the student immediately runs to the corners and looks at the corners and discovers there's no signature. Next, he begins to look at the faces. But to the student's disappointment, he cannot recognize Rembrandt's face in any of the characters. And after some time, the exasperated student says, "I've looked everywhere in this painting. I don't see him anywhere." The old gray-haired teacher stares admiringly at the painting and responds this way, "Student, you look for a signature, but I see the subtlety of artistic style. You look at their faces, but I see the character of the brushstrokes. You look at the painting and conclude that the artist is nowhere, but I look at the painting and see that the artist is everywhere." Friends, I say to you this, that in the book of Esther, Jesus is everywhere in this story. And in your silence, I want to say this to you just as clearly as I can, that God is in your story too. And sometimes you just need to back away from the painting and see how the brush strokes of life have been guiding and leading and directing. For Jesus is in your story too. And if you sense a simple, small tug at your heart as I speak, that is the call of God upon your life, saying, "I want to be a part of your story. I created you. I own you. Will you submit to me as king?" So Grace Life, when God is silent, he is still very, very active in your life. Let's pray. Father, there are some here today that feel very much like the nation of Israel in Persia. There's no prophet. There's no word from God. They open the Bible and it seems as if it's a closed book. But we know that what we are being taught is that even at the most silent times, you are accomplishing your plan, not only for our lives, but for the greater plan that you have to bring about your own kingdom. Father, give faith to these your people. May they hold on in the darkest of the nights. May they cling tightly to the sure and steady anchor, Christ.